And that preaching text today is Romans 12, verses 1 and 2. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. In the early 90s, Dr. Mark Plotkin, an ethnobotanist, wrote Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice, in which he chronicled his spiritual journey in learning the ways of a witch doctor. Obviously, not a Christian or a Christian missionary. He scoured the Amazon basin in search of healing plants and potions, and he discovered the methods of the shaman. Now, shamans, too, know every plant and herb and animal essence that they can use for healing. They heal everything from a mosquito bite to shrinking large tumors. But they also heal ostensibly by magic, attempting to manipulate the spiritual forces of nature to obtain a desired result. And one of the techniques they employ to contact and pacify those spirits is the sacrifice of small animals, especially chickens. The life force of the creature is supposed to be added to that of the shaman and or his patient. And here we have modern science in reverse. Healers going back into the old ways to discover in many cases what has been lost, that's true, but also eschewing that which was meant to be left behind. Magic, shamanism, left behind, hopefully, although we see the resurgence of that in many quarters of our culture. I remember a missionary doctor returning from the field on furlough describing his encounter with a local shaman in Brazil. When he had first arrived on the field, the shaman hated him, seeing him as competition in the tribe. He cursed him, cast spells, sacrificed small animals to enact his curses and spells, and this went on for over a year until the shaman went down with appendicitis. Who do you think performed the appendectomy? Of course, it was the missionary doctor. And the shaman became one of his first and most loyal converts, too, in that tribe. He was transformed. He was transformed from a spirit of fear to a spirit of sonship, from the worship of demons to the worship of the one true God, from offering dead sacrifices to offering himself as a living sacrifice, the title of our message today. The shaman said, I now see the true meaning of sacrifice, not of dead animals, but of myself as a living sacrifice for Jesus, who gave himself in sacrifice for me. Living sacrifice. Let's look at this powerful metaphor for what our lives should look like following our justification. How do we live as righteously as we've been declared to be, right? That's the idea of justification, to be declared righteous in God's court of law before his bar of justice. Well, as a consequence, how do we live as righteously as we have been declared to be? Let's look at our text today because it's going to introduce this for us. Two verses, but they're dense, well-packed verses that we need to unpack today. Verse 1, living sacrifice. As a consequence of the once-for-all sacrifice of Christ, now making you righteous, you are now a living sacrifice in a life of worship. Well, wonder of wonders, we now commence the last major section of Romans, and that is chapters 15 through 16. And we're still on our theme. Romans is an extended treatise on the righteousness of God, right? Romans is an extended treatise on the righteousness of God. We've seen, we've begun with what is righteousness? It is an attribute of God by which he is just and rules his creation justly. Why do we need it? Because no creature can stand before him or serve in his presence for eternity without being righteous. Perfectly so. We need it if we are going to be saved, in other words. It may not be high on your priority list. It may not be on your bucket list to become righteous, but it should be right at the top, shouldn't it? Nobody should kick the bucket until they are assured that they are just and righteous before God. Because no man will see God without holiness, without being righteous. You need it. How is that righteousness obtained by us from him? Even more so, how was it attained by Christ for us? We saw those answered, did we not, in earlier chapters? We've just finished an extended digression in chapters 9 through 11, too. Why is this righteousness seeming to be tipped towards Gentiles more than Jews? We answered that question, too. And now Paul, in these chapters, 12 through 16, he's going to unfold, he's going to demonstrate for us how this righteousness is now lived out. How do we live as righteously as we have been declared to be? Paul here now, in chapter 12 and verse 1, transitions from inculcating vital truth to them to asking for particular behavior from them. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers. Is therefore indicates that what follows is a necessary consequence of what has gone before. A necessary consequence of what has gone before. That is, the whole point of making man righteous is that he might then live as the creature he was made to be. He's now fit to be that before God. John Murray puts it this way. He says, characteristic of Paul's teaching is that ethics must rest upon the foundation of redemptive accomplishment. Ethics must rest upon the foundation of redemptive accomplishment. There's no relativity in God's ethics as there is in modern American ethics. They are absolute, resting upon redemptive accomplishment. And Paul can make this appeal to his brothers. I appeal to you, brothers, on the basis of the mercies of God, too. By the mercies of God. That's the sense of the by there. That is, on the basis, on the foundation of the mercies of God. This is what we owe. The behavior that is outlined and sketched, sometimes in great detail, in chapters 12 through 16, is what we owe to God. God has showered undeserved favor. That's the sense of mercy. We deserve punishment. We deserve wrath. But instead, we have received his favor, his mercy. He has showered that mercy upon us. And the true loving response to that mercy involves what follows, Paul is saying. What indeed does follow? Well, we are to present, we are to offer our bodies as a living sacrifice. A living sacrifice, an oxymoron at the temple. What Paul has done is usher us from a logical, systematic, doctrinal setting, which we've seen for some weeks now, into one of temple worship in one fell swoop. We are now in temple settings, with temple language. All of the Greek language used here is found in the Septuagint. That's the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible throughout Leviticus. We have sampled a little bit of that today from chapter 1 of Leviticus. The Septuagint's the Greek translation of the Hebrew. Leviticus is the book of sacrifice, too. This is temple talk. We are to present or offer. The Old Testament saint, and this is how, if you were faithful to God under the Old Covenant, this is how you would worship. You would bring your animal or your grain offering from the farm to Jerusalem. You'd make your way through the various courts of the temple to the altar of sacrifice, and there would be standing the priest and his assistants. And then as a sacrifice, that animal would be presented or offered. You would present, first of all, yourself and your sacrifice before the priest, and he would look you over and take your certificate, perhaps, and take your animal. If it were a sin offering, a Heleb Machama, he would lay his hand, then the worshiper, you would lay your hand upon the head of that creature, symbolically identifying your life with that creature, that lamb perhaps, which is what was owed for your sin, is your life. And then you personally would slit its throat. Very graphic portrayal of what you owe God. And there would be no qualms or queasiness about slitting the throat of that poor little lamb, that innocent little lamb. You must do it for the remission of sin, for atonement. The New Testament saint does not have to do this, does he? The priest would then take that animal and flay it according to Levitical instruction, as we saw in our text today, our reading from the law. Well, you are to present now, you are to offer your body. You are now to offer your body before God. Very particular word here. One commentator points out that it's not the person and not his soul. No, a very particular word used here, your body you are to present. Because biblical religion is no airy-fairy otherworldly religion. We are embodied persons, are we not? Genesis says, then the Lord God formed the man of dust from the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living creature. We are living creatures. If you bring your body, your soul, your spirit is not far behind, is it? God would then pronounce this creation good, would he not? The body is good. Paul at once affirms the goodness and propriety of the body against the spiritualist cults of the day. Many of the Gentiles were coming into the life of the church from these cults. There was, of course, docetism. Docetism from the Greek word dokeo, meaning to seem. That is, Christ just seemed to be a man, just seemed to have a body, only appeared to. No. Or Gnosticism, too. It says, by you are saved in the mind and in the spirit. The body is blemished and evil and must be left behind. No. Christianity says we are embodied persons. Our bodies are saved. Our bodies are now claimed by God, holy, sacred to God, and we are to present them to him as a sacrifice, as a living sacrifice. Now, the Old Testament saint repeatedly sacrificed too, didn't he? The life and body of an animal as a substitute for his sin. The New Testament saint has Christ sacrificed once for all his life and body as a substitute for his sin. We now live no longer unto death. Well, then, how are we to present those bodies? We are to present those bodies as a living sacrifice, Paul says. How profound and multifaceted is this phrase? Temple language again. Sacrifice in the Old Testament was predicated on the death of the creature. Living sacrifice is that oxymoronic phrase under the temple system, right? Yet in the New Testament, it is predicated on the continuing life of the sacrifice. Christ died that we might live. His death served the purpose of our death, didn't it? Well, Once again, put yourself in the place of the old covenant worshiper. You would walk away from the altar of sacrifice alive, leaving behind that dead animal. But you would be deeply conscious of the transaction just completed, graphically illustrated for you. The nature of your sin before God was such that blood had to be shed, life had to be taken, and a creature of great value had been presented before God. And all of this was but a substitute for that which was owed, your blood, your life, your presentation before the altar. But in the back of your mind, you would also know that you would be back. The substitute was not final. It merely anticipated. It looked forward to a final sacrifice. And on this went. Contemplate this. And on this went, off and on, for over a millennia. In seeming perpetuity, right? Until, of course, Christ's own final sacrifice. And Paul is hearkening back to ground that he's previously covered too. He says, back in chapter 3, for example, he says, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God and are justified by his grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God put forward as a propitiation by his blood to be received by faith. God presented an offering at the cross. God put forward Christ, presented Christ as a propitiation, that is, as a sacrifice to quell the wrath and anger of God by his blood, by Christ's blood. And this, of course, is to be received by faith. So Paul is hearkening back then to ground he's already covered. But Christ, unlike the Old Testament sacrifice, this one was of infinite value and efficacy, which is why we're not sacrificing one of our little goats here today, right? Because Christ's once sacrifice of himself brings infinite value and efficacy. The author of Hebrews puts it this way: he entered once for all into the holy places, not by means of the blood of goats and calves, but by means of his own blood, thus securing an eternal redemption. There's that sense of infinite value and efficacy. No more blood sacrifice. That blood sacrifice is now remembered, isn't it? We still have a bloody religion before us in the cup, but we aren't sacrificing little Dante today, one in the name of one of our goats. Although some days I'd like to. The new covenant believer, however, is thus released. He is liberated from this bloody system forever. The sacrifice he now presents is his own body, continuously living in service to God. Calvin puts it this way. He says, by calling it living, he intimates that we are sacrificed to the Lord for this end, that our former life, being destroyed in us, we may be raised up to a new life. The following chapters really are an extended treatise as well on sanctification, on being made holy. You, as a New Testament believer, can now freely, gladly, joyously offer your body alive to God to do with as he pleases. To do with as he pleases. The author Frederick Robertson puts it this way. He says, sacrifice alone, bare and unrelieved, is ghastly, unnatural, and dead. But our living sacrifice, illumined by love, is warmth and life. It is the death of Christ, the life of God, the blessed and only proper life of man. He gets it. Robertson gets it. You are now that living sacrifice. The death of Christ, the life of God, the blessed and only proper life of you. Paul also qualifies you as holy. That is, you are sacred. You are set aside for God's service now. You are acceptable to Him. Acceptable. Temple language again. That which is accepted, right? We saw that word throughout Leviticus chapter 1. You find it throughout the book of Leviticus. Being acceptable. You are a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord now. In the act of presenting yourself before the altar of sacrifice, the attributes of life, holiness, and acceptability will be made manifest. Will be made manifest. But you must do it. You must offer yourself. You must belly up to the altar, so to speak, and offer your life as a living sacrifice. It will remain unknown to you unless and until this act of presentation, of offering, is made. It is demanded of you, required of you. You will do it if indeed God has been at work in you. I took up rock climbing in Boulder, Colorado, back in the 70s. I thought about it a long time. My friends were doing it. I wondered, I imagined, I listened, I gulped, and then I did it. I just did it. It wasn't easy. In rock climbing, there's moments of sheer terror, but also moments of great and profound exhilaration. I miss it. But they were moments that I never knew until I stepped out on the rock. So too, you may toy with God in terms of your offering yourself as a living, holy, pleasing sacrifice, but you will never know what it means to be living holy and acceptable to God until you do step up to the altar and offer yourself. But when this happens, when you do this, you are fulfilling as well your prime directive as a person, as a living being, the chief end of man, which is to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. Boy, that rings true, doesn't it? Somebody should write that down. Because you are now glorifying God, enjoying Him forever. You are performing your spiritual service of worship, your spiritual worship, as the English Standard Version, and just the delight, the density of this phrase here comes out in the variety of translations, and most of them are very good, and they tease out different aspects of this too. Your spiritual worship is the English Standard Version, is perhaps the barest of them, but it's fine. The New American Standard translates this phrase as your spiritual service of worship. Latreia there can be translated either worship or service. And there's much of both in both of those words. The NIV puts it your spiritual act of worship. That's good too. The King James Version, great standby. Your reasonable service, right? It makes sense. It's fitting. The idea of fitting service, fitting worship, latreia. This is just the consequence of your redemption, brothers. As a result of it, there are several imperatives too. Several imperatives that Paul exhorts upon us. And that brings us to verse 2. Living sacrifice. All of you squirming in your pews right now are living. Living sacrifices. As a consequence of the once-for-all sacrifice of Christ, now making you righteous, you are now a living sacrifice transformed to the will of God. You are now a living sacrifice transformed to the will of God. We still have much in the way of temple language here. Temple setting. Now, Paul sketches several broad generalities in our sanctification before digressing into the particulars. Chapters 12 through 16 will be just an elegant, thorough digression into the particulars of sanctification. You're wondering, how do I discern the will of God? How do I know His will for me? Well, spend some time, put your nose in these chapters, and you'll find out quickly. Those generalities consist of, first of all, two contrasting imperatives. Notice the two contrasting imperatives. That is, do this. That's the idea of imperative. Or do not do this, right? Two contrasting imperatives. Do not be conformed to this world. Sou schematizo. Do you hear the word schematics in there? The word, we get our word schematics from the form or shape of something. Paul says, do not be, first of all, conformed to this world. And secondly, be transformed. An imperative. Do, be transformed by the renewal of your mind. Metamorphao. You, of course, hear the word metamorphosis in there. Do not be conformed to this world. The conformity by which the world molds us is a terrible regimentation, isn't it? If you fall under the regimentation of the world, how awful and ugly and sinful and fearful and painful it becomes. Pinocchio is one of my favorite allegories of what it means to grow into true manhood, into true personhood. Now, Pinocchio is also a fun Walt Disney cartoon, right? Film. But it's also much, much more than that when you have a chance just to sit down and read it. It is an allegory, a parable of what it means to grow into true manhood, true boyhood. Pinocchio, of course, begins wooden with strings, controlled by others, shaped and molded by, conformed to this world, isn't he? We see as he goes out into the world, begins smoking cigarettes, playing pool. Oh. He becomes a jackass, doesn't he? As he becomes conformed to the world. And it is only in the power of brave deeds and self-sacrifice that he becomes a man. He, of course, practically dies in saving his father, Geppetto. And in the quest, he goes from being conformed to the world to being transformed from within into a real flesh and blood boy, doesn't he? No strings any longer. Not controlled by others. He no longer needs an exterior conscience either. Very important. Jiminy Cricket is a cute little cartoon character. You know, let your conscience be your guide. Jiminy Cricket, see you later, Pinocchio. You don't need me anymore because he has interiorized the conscience. Every child should, every parent should teach their children the conformity and transformity, if you will, of Pinocchio. The transforming parable, allegory of Pinocchio. What is your pressure point of conformity? We all seem to have those pressure points where we're weak. Is it the fear of man, perhaps, that stuffs a lot of people into a conformist box? The fear of man lays a snare, Solomon says, but whoever trusts in the Lord is safe. Maybe it's lack of trust in God's provision that conforms you to the world and its demands. Pleasure conforms many people. Pride, perhaps. Do not be conformed, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, because the Holy Spirit is at work in you, transforming you even now. That's also the sense of sanctification, that you are being made holy. Not only holy in terms of your righteousness, your morality, your ethics, your behavior, but also holy in terms of being set aside further and further for God's service. That's also an aspect of holiness we don't always see. But holiness also means that you are set aside for active service, increasingly, by the renewal of your mind. So that's as a consequence, right? As a consequence of your being made holy, by testing, that is by actually putting yourself in life's crucible, by stepping out onto the rock, if you will, presenting yourself before God, by testing, you may discern. You may discern, that word there meaning to prove or to justify, to prove or to justify. This word is also used, for example, in other places of the New Testament, in Luke 14, verse 19, where when Christ beckons a man to follow him, he says, I have just bought 5 yoke of oxen, and I go to try them out. Same word. The idea of testing or proving a thing. Please excuse me, the man says. Paul says in Galatians chapter 6, each one should test his own work. Same word used there. Each man should test, that is to prove, his own work. By testing, you may discern. Then, discern what? Discern what is the will of God, our text says. What is the will of God? Ever wonder what the will of God is for your life? A lot of young Christians, especially if they are hesitant about presenting their lives as that living sacrifice, ponder, scratch their heads over the will of God. What is the will of God for my life? That's one of the big questions, right? How do I determine God's will? Astrology, maybe. You read your horoscope every day. Have you had your chart done? What sign are you? I'm a stop sign. Please, don't go any farther. Maybe you lay out a fleece before God. Maybe you test God. A lot of young Christians do this as well. Or, of course, there's also always those dreaded words, the Lord spoke to me, right? The Lord told me that I need to move to Las Vegas with my credit cards. Yeah, no. As an elder told me as a very young man in the Reformed Church in which I grew up, he said, if the Lord is speaking to you, then it's probably not the Lord. Right? It's much more difficult to discern the Lord's will for you His way, isn't it? John Murray puts it, the will of God is the law of God. Oh no, stop. Don't tell me. Don't bring the Bible before me. That's much too hard. The will of God is the law of God, and the law is holy and just and good. He's already pointed this out to us back in chapter 7, isn't it? It's much more difficult to discern God's will this way, His way. That is by offering ourselves as a living sacrifice. You begin to offer yourself as a living sacrifice and begin to read God's word and apply it in your life. You begin to do God's will. That is God's will. The problem with a living sacrifice, though, is it tends to crawl off the altar, doesn't it? We tend to do that. We maybe offer ourselves once and then say, oh, I don't know. You know, for the next few months, I'm crawling off the altar. I'm living for myself. No, that idea of living sacrifice is a continuous one. We are continually offering ourselves. It's much more difficult, much easier to go to the horoscope, put out a fleece, say the Lord spoke to me, rather than rather than being transformed. That is much more difficult. Rather than eschewing the conformity with the world and transforming our lives, and then as you begin to have your will conformed, you find the things you choose are indeed in conformity with His. As you consult with other Christians who are of the same mind, you find their advice dovetailing with yours. As you begin to read the wisdom literature, because discerning the will of God, particularly in particular lives, requires the wisdom of God as well. Spend time in the wisdom literature, and you will find the will of God becoming clearer and clearer for you in your particular circumstances. Then, as you do conform your lives to the will of God, you discover what is good, and you become as well what is good and acceptable and perfect. Now, this in the Greek is susceptible of several translations, and you have, they amount somewhat to the same thing. You see in a footnote there, you have an alternative to what the ESV has, and many other translations have this, but I like the way the ESV has translated this, because it means that you become what is good and acceptable and perfect. And these, the idea of being good, acceptable, and perfect, these are, once again, descriptors of sacrificial lambs. We are still in the midst of temple talk here. What is good and acceptable and perfect? What is good? That is, what is savory? We saw in our text this idea of being good. That is, it shall be a pleasing aroma to the Lord. What is acceptable? If you just flip over to Leviticus 1, you see, he shall bring it to the tent of meeting, that is the animal, that he may be accepted before the Lord. Same word. He goes on to say, he shall lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering, and it shall be accepted for him to make atonement for him. There's that idea of being acceptable, of acceptance before God. Temple talk. That you might be good and acceptable and perfect, right? Leviticus 1, if it is a male from the flock or the herd, it must be a male without blemish. It must be perfect. This was true of all the sacrifices. We saw God's reaction to imperfect sacrifices in Malachi, didn't we? Utterly requisite for it to be perfect. The Passover lamb was kept at the temple. It's true of all sacrifice had to be without blemish, but the Passover lamb offered for the nation at Passover at the temple was kept at the temple a week before Passover. It was examined by the priests in turn minutely to ensure that it was all the above, good, acceptable, and perfect. Perhaps coincidentally, Christ spent the entire week before Passover, his last Passover, in the temple precincts. Remember? John brings this out in particular. Being examined by who? By the priests, the scribes, the doctors of the law, every Jew under the sun, right? Pharisee, Sadducee, all of them tried to test him and find fault with him. But there he was. The Lamb of God without blemish. Good, acceptable, and perfect. Well, Paul is saying, so shall you be. Only you'll be a living sacrifice. This is your sanctification. God is making you good and acceptable and perfect. And He will finish you such if you present yourself to Him and then pursue a life of sanctification, of being made holy, of being more and more in His service. So shall you be. Good, acceptable, and perfect. Only you will be a living sacrifice. Well, Pastor, then, you've awakened an interest in me. How do I become this? How do I become sanctified, holy, set aside? Aha! If that's the case, then I have you. I have you for the remainder of chapters 12 through 16. Because Paul will then begin to sketch for us what it looks like to be now what you've been declared. Holy, righteous, and just before God. To be continued. But until then, let us see how that we have been made a living sacrifice through the final sacrifice of Christ as we come to the supper of the Lord.